ESPN College Football Podcast.
Welcome to the College Football Podcast. It is early March, and it's good to be back. Good to see some familiar faces in Sarah and Taylor. A fun show in front of us. We've got Field Yates fresh off the combine and get his thoughts about who stood out. And you know, Field has a background before he came to ESPN with scouting in the NFL, his time with the Chiefs, also with the Patriots. So he's going to give us some insight on how NFL teams prepare. Is it a 365-day a year project here with the draft? When do they put up their big board? And what stands out when it comes to the guarantees and fulfilling needs on a board, especially from what we've seen in a very unique draft? And also, I found out a couple things about Field's background. I've worked with him for a decade at ESPN. Did not know he was a two-sport athlete, and that's where we'll start as we take a look at the NFL draft with the stars from college football. Yeah, doesn't really need an introduction, but I do want to get to it. Good friend, NFL insider, fantasy insider, Field Yates joining us now as he does a handful of things at the network, including hosting the First Draft podcast with Mel Kiper and Todd McShay. And usually it's just Field putting it on a tee and laying out and listening to two guys bicker for about 5 to 10 minutes before they get to a topic because they love the sport so much and they love each other. And Field handles it so well because he was at the combine over the weekend. So we thought it'd be a great time to bring his thoughts and opinions about the draft, as well as what he has seen from some of college football's brightest stars. Before we get to that, Field, when I did some research, you know, the background on Field, of course, is he had some time with the New England Patriots, as well as the Kansas City Chiefs, working in their scouting department, worked with Todd Haley as well. But you were a two-sport athlete at Wesleyan. You played safety. What was the other sport, Field? That's what I'm trying to find out. I was trying to figure out with your size at 5'11", 200 pounds.
Yeah, I was a lacrosse player. And let me be very clear about this, Kevin. Being on the team and being like a useful part of the team are two very dissimilar things, right? There is a guy, I'm sure you probably know him, of course, Mark Titus, who covers college basketball now for Fox Sports, mm-hmm. and he had Club Trillion. That was his infamous, I think famous sort of tagline during his days at Ohio State on the Hoops team, along with mm-hmm. Greg Oden and Mike Conley, because he would play, you know, the Club Trillion. 1 minute played and zero stats registered. I'm not sure if there's a lacrosse or football equivalent of that, but that would be where I would, that's how I would categorize my football and lacrosse career. 2 years on the football team, 4 years on the lacrosse team. And the greatest benefit that I think I brought to either of those programs was either like A, I was just like a warm body in practice when they needed somebody, or B, I secured number 38, which I would argue is one of the uglier numbers amongst all uniforms available. That it was like, I didn't come there and say, I want like, I don't know, 6 or 12 or some like really cool number that a top recruit would want. So those are like my two greatest contributions to the various athletic programs at Wesleyan. But no surprise, they've gotten way better at sports since I left the school as well.
Stop. You're so modest about it. But you bring up one really good point. Like the number 38, when you look at the 30s, like we can all recite players that we've grown up with in the 30s, especially, you know, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, yeah. even 35. It gets a little, 36 for me, Brian Westbrook and Philadelphia with the Eagles. Yeah. It gets weird at 37, 38, because at 37, you're thinking, are you a safety? And that feels perfect for you at your position, 38 as well. Like, what was that like? The 38, such a weird, was that a special number for you?
No, I think what happened was when they were issuing numbers my freshman year, and I sound self-deprecating, but I'm also being honest with you, is that like they gave me the available numbers and it was like 38 or like 41 or like some other like equally ugly number. So they were like, listen, you're not that far off the totem pole. All right. So, you know, if like you were more of a prized recruit, then maybe we would change things up. I did sort of rationalize it by telling myself, you know, in lacrosse, typically the numbers on a roster only go up until about 40 or 45 because the lacrosse team is much smaller than a football team. So I said, maybe I can double dip and go 38 in football and lacrosse. And then, you know, at Division III, at least when I was there at Wesleyan, like when you got gear from a team, Like you paid for it, right? So like if you buy like, you know, there was some stuff that was given to you, but if you bought like, you know, the sweatpants or the sweatsuit for that year, it wasn't like they just, you know, gifted you that sweatsuit. It was, you know, it was like $125. And once I already had a, you know, 38 gear that freshman year, my mom has always been the kind of mom that wanted like endless gear from whatever team I played on. She still got stuff from when I was in middle school that she wears to this day. And I was like, you know, something, we're already invested in this number, so let's just ride it out. You know, they're not going to remember my career anyways. So I figure just go down in the blaze of glory with number 38.
Well, you're number 38. That's retired in the rafters in the Field Yates household. As you are now a proud father and you're juggling a lot of things. Congratulations to you and Chapin with that. And obviously, you know, you're dealing with that. You're dealing with a first-time father and then dealing with the idea of gearing up for the draft. And usually on the College Football Podcast in the offseason, we go through letters. And the letter of the day here on the podcast is G. And I thought that was a perfect letter specifically for this conversation. And we're going to go through all that. And we're going to start with specifically G for Georgia.
Yeah.
And they were, that was the most dominant unit when it came to conversations in Indianapolis at the combine. You could use also good God with the 40 times that we saw from, you know, a lot of the players on the defensive side, led by Kalen Barnes at Baylor, as well as the wide receivers who dominated the topic. But let's start with Georgia here and that defensive unit that showed out in Indy. Jordan Davis, Trayvon Walker, Devontae Wyatt. What were your takeaways from that experience and watching these guys in the shorts and short sleeve Olympics?
Yeah, that's what, which is what they are. But I do think it's important to note, Kevin, that nobody who is shining a light on the combine is suggesting that what takes place in Indianapolis is the end all be all for these prospects. It does not mean that just because Jordan Davis is faster than any other human of his size, that automatically makes him the best football player in this draft or something of that nature, right? It's just a piece of context. I remember my scouting days, we used to call it a puzzle, and every piece of the puzzle had to fit in order for you to want to invest in a player. But the combine can help you either dig deeper on guys that you feel like maybe you didn't have the perfect grasp on. Like, are we overthinking or not putting enough attention onto this player? Or it can also confirm some things. Like the first player we drafted when I was in Kansas City was Eric Berry. And we loved him. He was unbelievable at Tennessee. He was an unbelievable player in the NFL as well. But he goes to the combine and he crushed it. And you were like, my goodness, like as if, you know, if he had gone there and run 4.7 or something, maybe we'd have to reconsider a couple of things. But he just sort of affirmed what we already thought. Now, that's a top of the draft player. But there are guys in the middle of the rounds where you sort of have that same experience. But to bring it back to Georgia, I think everybody wants to talk about Jordan Davis. I'll go in a little bit different order only because I'll go in the order that I think they're most likely to be selected. I think Trayvon Walker is going to be selected first amongst all Georgia players. Defensive end, edge player, whatever you want to categorize him as. He had a remarkable combine as well. And it sort of went under the radar because of Jordan Davis. But he ran a 4.5 140 at 270, I think it was 275, somewhere in that range. Like, he is a big, powerful man who's got incredible explosiveness as well. And obviously was a terrific player for Georgia, even if like the numbers don't blow you away last year, like he was a dominant force for them. So Trayvon Walker, I think, has a chance to be the highest player selected from Georgia. And then I think we start to have the Jordan Davis conversation. And one thing that I think is important to remember about Jordan Davis is that we want to use one size fits all rules for the draft, especially when you're somebody like Mel and Todd, who is not going into the draft process saying like, hey, just to make this, you know, Jordan Davis fits the Cleveland Browns like this. No, it's Jordan Davis fits the league like this. You have to speak generally, but maybe for some teams, Jordan Davis wouldn't be a first round pick because they're saying, you know, something, a guy that's going to play for sure on running situations or, you know, short down and distances, like, yeah, He will be extremely valuable for us in those, but if we're not very good defensively right now and we're consistently playing nickel defense where you don't necessarily need your best run stuffer on the field, then he may not be worth a first round pick. But where I think he could be worth a first round pick is if you are a team that has a massive eyesore for a run defense right now, and the Los Angeles Chargers at pick 17, by the way, happen to have amongst the biggest eyesores at run defense in the NFL right now, like he might be worth it for them because he might address their most glaring weakness with just one pick. He's a really unique guy. The 4.78 40 is not necessarily applicable day in and day out or play in and play out. How often is he running 40 yards? But just another testament to how ridiculously explosive he is, because he is, I mean, despite the fact that he's 341 pounds, like his, the way that he moves is, I mean, you take 100 pounds off and it's still impressive. At 241, he would be an impressive mover. The fact that he's doing it at 341 is just ridiculous.
I mean, when you're running in the numbers of what a 4.78 at that weight is, it's insane. And I know he put on some weight in the postseason, the SEC championship, with different story. We didn't see a lot of him. They had to pull him multiple times. And then, you know, in the postseason, of course, and in the playoffs. So you lose that weight in that time. Can he maintain that weight? Cause he's an athletic freak. Yeah. No doubt at 6'6" and how he can carry himself. That will play a role here. Let's continue here with the theme. And the word is now great. Who had a great performance in your mind in Indy?
So Jordan Davis, and I'll just end it here. Like, Jordan Davis did have a great performance in Indy, like, because it wasn't just the 4.78 40. Like, there were other elements. His workout was really strong. I thought, just like generally speaking, he just checked all the boxes that he could check. It's going to be ultimately a matter of how do teams value that position. But I thought that the two offensive tackles at the top of the board, Evan Neal from Alabama and Ike Ekwonu from North Carolina State, also had a great week in Indianapolis. They're not the same. Evan Neal is 6'7", 332 pounds. But my goodness, if you saw him, Kevin, like, he looks more like a basketball power forward. Mm-hmm. And he does a left tackle in the NFL. He is lean. He is just ridiculously, like, he's chiseled for a guy of that size. Not saying he's the exact same player, but you know, they're like, when you think about some of these guys that carried their weight incredibly well, left tackle, you think about Tyron Smith right now for the Dallas Cowboys. You think about Jonathan Ogden, a Hall of Famer for the Ravens, who looked like he could play. He probably could have played power forward because he was 6'9". Coming out of UCLA. So he's a player that, even if he doesn't look like a left tackle, has all the necessary traits to be a great one. And beyond that, as you know, he played three different spots at Alabama. He played a different position for each year. Like, the fact that he's played guard and right tackle and left tackle, that, like, if you're a team that already has your left tackle in place, you don't necessarily have to worry about whether or not Evan Neal projects at right tackle, which is becoming an increasingly more important position. Meanwhile, Ike Ekwonu at North Carolina State, not as long, not as tall as Evan Neal, but he is just nasty out there on the field, and he's an athletic whiz as well. He ran a sub-5.40 again, not the most important thing, but all of his on-field drills were really, really solid. He's going to have this beautiful footwork to him. He has just ascended this past year. He was really good, obviously, in his years prior to this past year, but this year was his breakthrough performance, and I really did think coming out of Indy, Kevin, that he would be the number one pick in the draft. I've since changed my mind a little bit because the Jaguars used the franchise tag on Cam Robinson for the second straight season. If you're double tagging a guy with the intention of just letting him play out that deal, that to me feels like, I would say that's poor football business. I would imagine Jacksonville is motivated to extend him. And if they do, then I don't know they're going to use the number one pick on a player in Ike Ekwonu to move him to right tackle. You might be better suited to tap into one of these two, or one of the premier pass rushers, whether it's Kayvon Thibodeau or, most people believe, Aiden Hutchinson.
And that actually is a great segue, because Todd McShay just released his latest mock. Now, this is different from his big board and the rankings of players, because he's looking at needs specifically and targets. And, you know, Ekwonu was one of those guys that I think a lot of people in the last couple of weeks were just saying that, okay, we're going to see one of the tackles, Ekwonu number one of the Jaguars, even Neal number one of the Jaguars, we saw in January. Right now, in this latest release by McShay, which came out today, the Jaguars are going with Aiden Hutchinson out of Michigan at number one. The Lions going with Kyle Hamilton, the safety out of Notre Dame. And Kyle's growth, we've seen the buzz around him. He's not the burner, but he does everything. And he has a different type of speed. The game speed, I always say there's Jerry Rice game speed that's completely different from, you know, run point A to point B, that where you separate yourself. If you watch the tape, Hamilton's all over the place. Ekwonu going to the Texans at 3 out of NC State. Evan Neal at Alabama going to the Jets at 4. Trayvon Walker, of which is talked about, out of Georgia, going to the Giants at 5. Charles Cross, another tackle out of Mississippi State, going to the Panthers at 6. Garrett Wilson, first wide receiver off the board out of Ohio State, going to the Giants. And then Drake London right after, USC wide receiver, going to the Falcons. And then it's Kayvon Thibodeau. Now that's a Seahawks pick at number 9, Thibodeau out of Oregon. Yeah, and they got that pick, of course, with the Broncos trade Russell Wilson yesterday. And then the Jets at 10, getting that pick from Seattle with the Jamal Adams trade. Ahmad Sauce Gardner, the cornerback out of Cincinnati. So there's a lot of movement here. I imagine there's going to be more movement in the next few weeks before the end of April when we have the draft. When you see the movement there with Thibodeau, specifically, you know, at the beginning of last season, Oregon hyped up. We know what he was like coming out of high school and projected to be number one. Now I saw there was, you know, at 5 with the Giants. Now it's at 9. Yeah. Does that surprise you? Your thoughts about Thibodeau there at 9 going to the Seahawks?
I want to put this sort of precursor to the conversation out there that when you're discussing top draft prospects, it's hard for every single bit of analysis that you deliver to be, this guy is perfect and he's flawless and he's the next Lawrence Taylor or maybe Aaron Donald, or maybe two of them wrapped into one. Because the reality is, I always remind people, general managers are not paid to make the easy decisions. They're paid to make the difficult decisions. So when you're deciding about where Kayvon Thibodeau slots into the top 10 or so picks in the NFL draft, and you're weighing him at the top of the board versus some of these lead offensive tackles or some of these wide receivers, or, you know, even Aiden Hutchinson out of Michigan, it's not necessarily going to be that you point to areas where he is decidedly worse. It's just that other players offer like a little bit more. Kayvon Thibodeau might have the most unique traits of any defensive player in this year's draft. And that includes a draft where we have Kyle Hamilton, who's just he's a cyborg at a safety. But Thibodeau is long, he's wiry, he's explosive, he's got a knack for finding the quarterback. He had an interesting year this year playing through injury, but you know, he gutted through some stuff this year that I think other players could, you know what, I'm good. I know I'm going to the first round. I'll see you, I don't know, at reunions 5 years from now or whatever. But I think the questions are, and this is the reason why, and I know Todd has talked about this and frankly taken some heat for it, is like, are you getting the same player play in and play out? And how consistently are you getting that player? I tend to think that Thibodeau's ceiling is still uniquely high. And I think that Seattle pick 9 is like a really interesting fit because Seattle has always marched to the beat of its own drum in the draft. I mean, they've taken players that few thought would be first round picks. It goes way back. James Carpenter, a guard several years ago, more recently Rashad Penny as a running back. And then even Jordan Brooks a couple of years ago, he had like 200 tackles this past year, by the way, but they do what they want to do. They're not concerned about consensus boards, but they also love traits. They are a trait and develop team. In other words, Malik McDowell, a second round pick out of Michigan State a few years ago, who had, you know, his career flamed in Seattle before it even began. He finally got back in the NFL this past year with Cleveland, but they love guys with pretty unique tools. Veterans that they made or that they've helped develop into stars at that position. Cliff Avril, right? This is a guy that no one was talking about. Cliff Avril then became one of the best players in their franchise's history. Same thing with Michael Bennett. You know, Bruce Irvin was a first round pick who played a lot for a team that won the Super Bowl. So I think Seattle makes a lot of sense for Kayvon Thibodeau. I know it's going to be categorized as a bit of a drop, but I do think one thing that we on the outside are always, you know, should be mindful of is that, like, just because we have players ranked a certain way, it doesn't mean that the league views them in that exact same light. So before we can call them risers or fallers, it's probably worth digging in and like, were we just a little bit ahead of the curve on this player, a little bit too high from the get-go or too low from the get-go on this player?
Before we move on, a couple of things I want to mention. First, March is here. Get ready for the madness with Bald Men on Campus featuring College Game Day's three follically challenged hosts. That is Jay Billis, LaFonso Ellis, and Seth Greenberg. They're recording a monster NCAA tournament preview podcast right after the bracket is released on Sunday. I was with Fonz and Seth the other night, and they were already talking about that podcast. Then they're dropping new episodes twice a week throughout the tournament. You can listen to the Bald Men on Campus wherever you listen to your podcast. Make sure you listen to that podcast, of course, before you fill out your bracket and you beat everybody. And also watch NBA Today, 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on ESPN and the ESPN app. You can also listen to the show as a podcast. Let's jump off there with Seattle in the ninth pick and continue our letter of the day with the letter G, gamble. Because a lot of people were connecting now that Seattle acquired that ninth pick from the Broncos and they just traded Russell Wilson. Do you take a gamble on the quarterbacks? And this year, completely different from previous years where we've kind of gotten spoiled where the quarterbacks have dominated the conversation. And right now, there's just a lot of question marks with Kenny Pickett, Malik Willis, Sam Howell. You hear the Desmond Ridder, Matt Corral, where it's not so much are they going to be good players. It's do they fit teams specifically at where they're picking and the gamble that you have with a quarterback where you're – Mel and I have talked about this multiple times through the years where you just decide to overdraft and you roll the dice. And the gamble at quarterback, how do you view it? Because, of course, Kenny Pickett's hands was the big topic. Malik Willis turned a few heads with him throwing. If anybody's followed Malik Willis, you know that he has a big arm. He just turned a few heads because it was showcased in front of everybody outside of right. Liberty. Your thoughts about this gamble at quarterback and that topic here in round number one?
I would much rather prefer to be a team that has no need to be shopping this year quarterback than the inverse, Kevin. It's just a very, 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 very difficult market to size up. You and I have all heard the buzz surrounding Mitch Trubisky as a potentially coveted free agent in the NFL this year. Mitch Trubisky was available last year, Kevin, in free agency. He signed a one-year deal, I believe, for $2.5 million with the Buffalo Bills. And I get it. Like, not as many teams, A, needed a quarterback next year, and B, weren't in a position to draft a quarterback, right? We had five in the first round, so obviously there were five. Like, what? No matter what order they went in, like five, those five guys were going in the first round somewhere, somehow, right? And everybody thought, like, you place any of them in this year's draft, from Trevor Lawrence to Mac Jones at 15, and they're the first overall pick, and it's not even a question.
Absolutely. Well,
maybe not with Jacksonville, but they're number one overall prospect, I should say. Like, Mitch Trubisky was available last year and no one wanted him. And all of a sudden now he's a coveted commodity. And I could be wrong. Like, and I could be wrong in thinking that he doesn't have what it takes to like turn things around. But I'd have some pause if I were a team looking to acquire either a quarterback in free agency or in the draft. And I think part of the rub with the draft is that all of these guys are green. They all need time, right? Kenny Pickett's probably the most ready because he's had the longest career in college, 4 years at Pitt, and a guy that I think probably is viewed, whether this is fair or unfair, as the player that has the highest floor. Then, meanwhile, Malik Willis is the player viewed as having the highest ceiling. Like, if there's one guy in this class who could be special, it may be Malik Willis. Now, it's important to note that, like, my evaluation of all these guys is going to change based off where they go, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how much the tenor of last year's draft class has changed in 1 year, right? I mean, there was a time where people thought that the 49ers, if they had traded up to pick 3 and used it on Mac Jones, would be committing organizational suicide to use it on a player only as good as Mac Jones. But Mac Jones looks pretty good to me right now, right? I mean, it looks like, you know, he was, if not for an historic year by Ja'Marr Chase, he's the rookie of the year in the NFL. And, you know, it's a reminder the situation matters, right? He goes to New England where they've got an outstanding coaching staff. They've got a good offensive line, enough pieces around him, good running game, et cetera, et cetera. Where, so like, if Malik Willis landed somewhere where like there's an immense amount of pressure right away for him to win, or any of these quarterbacks, not just Malik Willis, but if any of them go somewhere where it's like, hey, they got to figure out how to win right now, it could be a problem. Meanwhile, if one of them went to Atlanta, for example, where Matt Ryan's the quarterback for this year, barring something completely unforeseen, like, that might be useful for them. And I know people lose their mind when a quarterback that's drafted in the first round has to play, has to sit on the bench for a year. But I'm not saying it always makes them better, but there are situations where it can help you get a little bit better. So there is a significant amount of risk and there is a gamble involved with any of these quarterbacks. My personal preference, again, if I had sort of apply this to every team, is, as I said, like, I think Malik Willis has the chance to be the guy that turns into, you know, that's the grand slam opportunity. I think Kenny Pickett is the player that I think has the chance to be like really solid, maybe not necessarily special, but really solid.
Comes down to fit. And it always does, right? No matter how good you are, specifically at the quarterback position, are you in the right environment? Can you grow? Are you thrown to the sharks early on? Does that stunt your development? And also, are you with teachers? And I bring that up because offensive coordinators and coaches play as big of a role as franchises do when it comes to the growth of a quarterback. And this is one of those years that you know, you could see a team potentially one of these guys drop in the late teens, and a team that's already built and has some good setup and good foundation. Let's just say like the Steelers, and yeah, that slides right in and okay, you're already in an organization that is stable and we could see that quarterback grow there and benefit down the road. And I think all these guys, like you mentioned, are so green that will benefit any of these quarterbacks if they were taken later in a draft with the expectations in round number one. All right. You know, I'm going to put you on the spot here, a little pressure. But continuing our theme here, guarantee. Who is the guarantee in this draft right now? And it could be Aiden Hutchinson. You just go with the number one pick, projected number one. Who's your guarantee in your mind?
Yeah, let's go a little bit further down the board, because like Ike Ekwonu, Evan Neal, like I like all those players. Aiden Hutchinson, the top of the board, like all of them to me scream like, you know, just like rock solid, going to be really good players for a long, long time. I'll go a little bit further down the board, though, and a player that actually didn't rock it in Indy. That's Devin Lloyd, linebacker from Utah, who ran, I think it was a 4.66 officially, maybe a 4.7 unofficially in the 40. And people are sitting there saying to themselves, like, whoa, like, Devin Lloyd, 4.66. Like, is that fast enough to be like, you know, you got to cover Travis Kelce, George Kittle, you know, Kyle Pitts, players like that, Dallas Goedert, like, you know, Mark Andrews, the list goes on of best tight ends in the NFL. Like, no way he can hang with them. And how about running backs out of the backfield as well? I'm not buying the 4.66 or whatever the official number was with Devin Lloyd. Just an unbelievably solid, productive, versatile player. Eight sacks last year, so he can rush the pass when you need him to rush the pass. He can blitz when you need him to blitz. Excellence in pass coverage. So he had four interceptions. Both those figures were tied for the most amongst all inside linebackers in NCAA Division I last year. This is something that I remember watching a Utah game, like caught my eye and I loved it. And I know it's like, this is stupid, maybe not that important, but I think it's the kind of stuff that catches coaches' eyes. Is I saw Devin Lloyd in the Pac-12 championship game, I think it was, against Oregon, had a pick six, 35-yard return or something, returns the ball in the end zone, and it goes right to the field goal protection team as the wing player. And I'm like, listen, he's the best player on Utah by far. If he doesn't want to play on special teams, he goes, coach, I'm good. I'm fine, right? The wing spot on the special teams, I mean, really any spot in the field goal protection unit, basically all you're doing is you're like, you're putting your arm out like a chicken wing and you're absorbing potentially 295, 300 pounds in the middle of the line, or, you know, a 200-pound defensive back bursting off the edge. Like it's a thankless job to call it. I mean, to put it politely, I love that about Devin Lloyd. It told me a lot about who he is as a teammate and who he is as a leader. So the numbers did not match up with what I would have thought they were based off of how he looked as a player on the field last year. But if I had to guarantee a guy being successful, Devin Lloyd's my answer.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the Utah way under Kyle Whittingham, right? Yeah. Everybody does something and show versatility. And that was their mentality, especially on the defensive side this past season with the Utes. And just a credit to what Whittingham has established as a culture and an identity with that team. He's the way you described it. I you know, and maybe it's a fault of mine. I naturally just say, oh, he's a Patriot. He does everything. He wears a lot of different positions. Help us understand, the listeners here, take us into the scouting department. And you had that time with the Chiefs. You were an intern as well, with the Patriots during your time there. What do you guys look at setting up for a draft? Do we have a board? How's that board set up as the season starts for college football to where it is in January to after the Senior Bowl to where it is after the combine? How do we put that together for people that want to go inside and understand?
The board is the best because there is a board. And the board is up 365 days a year. It might be up, might have like a 1 week break after the draft before we can turn it over to the 2023 draft. But the board is up at all times. It's subject to change at any moment. And the general manager is ultimately the one that dictates where the board is going. But you've got various people who are in senior positions as well that are influencing how the grades are stacked up. Every team grades differently. Typically, though, Kevin, there are sort of two general buckets that teams grade on. One is teams grade by round. That's a first round guy. It's a second round guy. It's a third round guy. Other, and I think this is where if I were a GM, I might lean, is they grade like what's his value, right? Because like, again, this year, Kenny Pickett's probably a first round pick. What was he last year though? So there's a little bit of like a misidentification in my opinion by just putting a player's value based off what round you assume he'll go in this year. So, you know, we'd say, hey, is he a first year starter? Is he a first-year backup? Is he a developmental starter? Is he a future All-Pro, future Pro Bowler, right? And you'd have got, you know, Randy Moss coming out would be a future All-Pro. You kind of feel good about that evaluation, understand the talents as unique as you can find, right? The other guys where you're like, you know something? Like, okay, here's an example of one. Like, maybe Jalen Hurts is a developmental starter, right? He's a guy that could be a starter in the NFL. It's going to take some time for him to reach his apex, but you could develop into him into a guy that could be a 10-year starter. So the board is constantly being updated. There are times where you're watching a group of players or individual player as a group and, you know, 10, 15 people in a room, and you're just sort of talking through the board. How's it all fit? But I remember we would try to do like a, I don't know, a clean sweep, but maybe like, let's call it, I don't know, five or eight times during the pre-draft process where it's like, all right, hey, like almost every magnet on the board is subject to change. Sometimes it's because you go to Indianapolis, now you have verified results and you go and you update all these, and each tag on a player has not just his name and his position, but like, what's his height? What's his weight? What's his speed? If there's a medical concern there, is he a guy that, you know, in the fall, before you know if a player is declared, is he draft eligible, but also could he return to school? So let's just make, hey, he's green if he's eligible to come out, but won't come out. Is not guaranteed to come out. Meanwhile, he's red if he's a senior and this is the last year. All kinds of tags. It gets sort of give you a various, you know, players have character concern. You got to make sure that's noted somewhere. If there's a player who, you know, what if he's not a fit for us, but he's a fit for the league. Those are the kind of things that you are seeing on these tags, which are constantly being updated and changed. But it was one of my favorite parts of the process was just seeing it. And while the draft itself, you have no idea what's going to happen beyond. I mean, this year, really, I have no idea what's going to happen anywhere. But in previous years, you have a pretty good feel for, let's call it, somewhere between like 2 to 4 picks. And then everything else is mayhem. And that was the part that I loved most, was that like seeing opinions that we felt throughout the process come to life in the draft. Not every player we liked we took, but it was cool to see when you sort of felt like as a group, you really honed in on this guy and then you took him. It was like, that was validation for all that work.
Love it. And when you look at this specific draft, we talk a little bit about position groups that start, and continuing our theme with the G in groups.
Yeah.
Defensive linemen will be a big storyline, especially in the first round and the conversation, specifically defense as a unit. The cornerback position, another G, and that is Sauce Gardner. Is he, in your mind, the standout singular cornerback that separates himself, or where do you put Derek Stingley out of LSU, Sauce Gardner out of Cincinnati, Derek Stingley out of LSU in this conversation when it comes to cornerbacks?
Yeah, Sauce ran really well. 4.41 was his official time. He was 6'2 6/8 of an inch. So when you see measurements, it's four numbers. It's the first one is how many feet. The next one is how many inches, and then the next two, because if he's 5'11", it would be 5'11", and then the last number is how many eighths of an inch. So it's 6.026 would be Sauce Gardner, which would be 6'2 6/8 of an inch, or 3/4 of an inch, as we call it. Checked all the boxes physically. I think he is probably viewed as the best cornerback in this draft, but I think you could probably find you did a straw poll, you could probably find 20%, 30% of evaluators who say, you know something, don't ever think it was Derek Stingley. Like, it's been a weird couple of years. Didn't play 2 years ago during the COVID year. This past year gets hurt early with the Lisfranc injury, which can be scary, but there's also a track record of guys coming back. He was special his first year, right? I mean, there was talk that he was the best player in terms of talent on that LSU team that won the national championship. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, amongst others, look really good right now themselves, but I'm not ready to overthink it there. I think you are drafting two day one starters that have the upside to be the number one cornerback on your team and be, I don't know about quite at the level that we saw Pat Surtain the second at last year from Alabama, but pretty close right away as a rookie.
The one thing is Stingley stands out physically, just like, okay, yeah, oh, he's off the bus guy. Yeah, I get it. I understand. And also what he did, you know, the games we don't see, and those are the practices where you're locked up against Justin Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase, right, in that freshman year where he's doing this day in and day out in practice. It's a Thibodeau type of conversation, right? It's like, yeah, okay, what are we going to see on film that stands out? But what do we see behind the scenes? And how do we transfer behind the scenes and that effort and practice to make sure he could stand out every single day on the NFL field, right? Yeah. And that is going to be another type of fit. Another group that has been dominant the last couple of years when it comes to depth, especially in rounds one and two, is wide receiver. And that's the same conversation here. We had wide receivers running in the conversation of 4-2, 4-3, 4-4 in Indy. And it can be a little deceptive, because the speed is one thing, and I made a joke a couple of times every time we saw something that was in the clocked in the, you know, the sub 4.2s, sub 4.3s. Oh, that's a Raider. That's a Raider.
Yeah.
But when Garrett Wilson ran 4.38, it turned a lot of heads. Garrett out of Ohio State and Chris Olave, another one who ran a fantastic, I don't know the number there, but it was inside 4.4.
I think it was 4.38 for Olave.
Olave,
4.36 for Garrett Wilson.
4.36.
So, like, okay. I mean,
that good, combination, huh? And then Drake London, who didn't run yet. And when you talk about the wide receivers in this draft in rounds one and two, who stands out?
There are a lot of them. You mentioned Drake London, which just like the film is fun, but the number that I love, the stat I love, is that he last played on Halloween and he still won Pac-12 Player of the Year, like Offensive Player of the Year. Like, he missed like five games, whatever it was, and still won the Offensive Player of the Year. And like, a good conference, right? This is not like a conference bereft of talent entirely. He's awesome. I can't wait to see where he runs. That'll play a big role, I believe, in establishing whether he's number one, number two, number three amongst those wide receivers. You know, Jameson Williams probably would be in that conversation from Alabama, if not for the ACL tear back in the national championship game. Sounds like he's progressing as you'd expect, just two-ish months removed from that initial injury. But there's an interesting, I would say, sort of like next tier. What we don't have this year in the first round that we had last year, at least in my opinion, is we had a guy last year in Elijah Moore who we thought could go in the first round. He ended up going to the top of the second round of the Jets. That was much more like the slot receiver than he was the perimeter receiver. This year, it's basically like all big perimeter guys. Both Ohio State players can really run, and they're both perimeter type targets. Jackson Smith and Jigba, who might be the best out of all these wide receivers.
Yep.
Eligible next year. He was the slot exactly. guy at Ohio State. Ridiculous player, obviously. He is. But you got both Ohio State guys, Jameson Williams, Treylon Burks from Arkansas, big physical freak. Didn't run, you know, incredibly at the combine, but still, like, pretty obvious to see that, you know, he's like a 4.55 at the combine is, I'm sorry, let me get that number right on Treylon Burks, but he wasn't like a burner in the way that, like, if he had run, I don't know, 4.37, we might be talking about him as the number one wide receiver in this year's class because he was so unique. But I think all the chance to be first round picks, stylistically, they're different, but they kind of more align as like the outside receivers versus the slot receivers. So I would just say that this is a good year again for wide receivers. And while we had a run for a while where it was hard to see these rookies contributing early, like, we've breathed some life into the idea that you can draft a guy early and he'll be a star for you. I mean, last year, like, who was better than Ja'Marr Chase? I mean, yep. Offensive Rookie of the Year, you know, Pro Bowl player, and he wasn't the only one, right? I mean, you know, Devontae Smith generated a lot of positive excitement for Philadelphia. You know, Jalen Waddle's had the rookie receiving record in terms of catches. Like, you can count on these players making major impacts right away.
100%. And you can find some talent that second and third round, like the Wandale Robinsons, out of Kentucky, Calvin Austin out of Memphis. Alec Pierce, another one from Cincinnati, who's kind of a freak bloodlines for him. Good crazy stuff. Now we're going to continue the theme.
Okay.
And we're going to go a little short term here when it comes to the answers, because these are pretty simple. Game.
Okay.
You love college football. What's your favorite game of all time? And it could be a personal experience.
All right. The best college football game I've ever been to myself. I went to the final game of Eddie George, his college career at Ohio State against Michigan. At the time, they were either renovating or like resurfacing the field. And I came home with like a patch of grass from the horseshoe, which was really cool for me. My mom's from Columbus, so I grew up going to a bunch of Buckeyes games growing up. That was always special for me. That was really cool. I think the game like I've watched, I tell you, the Rose Bowl this past year was up there, Ohio State, Utah. But I would think that probably the game that I watched that, and this is maybe low-hanging fruit because I think it applies to a lot of people, but USC, Texas, Vince Young, national championship game, Rose Bowl, like that's hard to beat there for me. Ohio State, Miami, the 2000 Miami team, I think it was January 2001 when the game, or maybe it was January 2002 when the game was played.
2002,
The Maurice Claret coming back and ripping the ball out after the interception and all those twists and turns of that game and the controversial pass interference call that breathed some more life into Ohio State. Those were the ones that come to mind for me. Now, I'm married to a Boston College graduate, and we go to a handful of Boston College games, as many as we can. We now live in Connecticut, but we live in Boston. We went to 4 or 5 a year. So we are optimistic with the program's direction right now. Coach Hafley, think the world of him. And I'm hoping for some big games up there at BC sooner rather than later.
Let's hope, especially at the quarterback position, right? There's a lot of promise moving forward. And Hafley's done a fantastic job with that program. All right. And that's a good segue here.
Okay.
GOAT. Who's your college football GOAT?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this because I thought about this prior to the show and I was thinking about it. I'm like, Archie Griffin's the only two-time Heisman winner, which, on that premise, like has a compelling case for him. Right. I'm trying to think of like the most dominant players that I saw during my lifetime. Like, I mentioned Eddie George, Ricky Williams certainly comes to mind. And then I was thinking about this more and more and more, and I'm wondering if it's like right beneath my eyes. Isn't it Nick Saban?
Oh,
and I know you're probably thinking more player vein, but it kind of feels like Nick Saban, right? I mean, all these national titles and like perennially being in the mix. Like, I think it's Saban. If you wanted to, I could talk myself into so many different directions as a player, as I just started to do, but it feels like Nick Saban might be the college football GOAT. Does somebody else, who came to mind for you?
I actually like the direction you're going into. I think you can mention a variety of different ones, especially it's all, to me, decade by decade, because you could go flavor of the month, what you've seen recently. You can go, hey, you guys don't understand what it was like to watch Herschel Walker back in the day, and like you mentioned Archie, or you can go Tim Tebow and what he did. So there's a handful of things. The one guy that, I don't know if he's a GOAT, but I just know what he brought up and how he made you feel specifically when you watched him was Reggie Bush in college.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not going by just numbers. It was just when Reggie had the ball, you knew something special was going to happen. So I will go with a variety of different people in that time. But when it comes to the last 15 years, the electricity of somebody on the field, and I'm watching them no matter what. I'm watching a USC Fresno State game late at night. I don't care. And I'm going to watch him put on a show and a performance. It would be probably Reggie Bush. And I'd always be curious to see how come it never really translated from what he did. Cause I thought he was a surefire, hey, the Saints are going to get one. I can't believe this. And he is going to be for the next 5 to 8 years, one of the most dominant players in the league.
Completely agree. Yeah. And I love watching him at the NFL level. And he had some moments, no doubt. Like he still broke some ankles and still made some incredible catches and had 80 plus catch seasons. But I would have 100% expected him to be like a franchise altering player. And Reggie's got onto a lot of success, during his career. He's a successful broadcaster now at Fox. Like, he's not going to be remembered as a bust, but I thought there was a chance that like he'd be the number one selling jersey for 10 years and he would be, you know, the next Marshall Faulk or Edgerrin James or player like that, that, you know, that really sort of catalyzed your offense for a decade.
Yeah. And again, this is not a knock on his NFL career. He still found a way. He still made an impact with the Saints and the Lions. And he was still fun to watch. It was just the expectations coming in completely different to where it was in college football to where it was in the NFL field. This has been a lot of fun, man. I appreciate you joining us here on the College Football Podcast. Learned a lot. And honestly, it's a great primer, I think, for the next 6 weeks when we hear all the rumors and the conversations of players going up and down and, you know, big boards and, you know, the latest mocks. It's all about fit, especially in a draft like this. Looking forward to you, of course, with more podcasts with Todd and Mel on the First Draft Podcast on the ESPN family of networks.
Kev, I always appreciate you, and I cannot wait. It's 50 days from when you and I are talking until the NFL draft. We cannot wait for what happens. And as of right now, I have no clue what's going to happen, which is the beauty of it all.
That's the best thing about the draft. Appreciate you, buddy.
Take care.
Big thanks to Field Yates hanging with us here to break down the combine as we are, as he mentioned, 50 days away from the NFL draft. So 7 weeks, cannot wait, because to me, it's the best reality TV. The NFL each and every day is phenomenal reality TV, but the actual draft in real time, and we could watch our college football stars move on to the next step in the biggest day of their lives. It's an awesome experience. Also, thanks for hanging with us with the letter of the day. That is G. And by the way, that song, as a father of three kids under 10, that song, that Sesame Street song, will stay in my head the rest of the day as we tackled G with a variety of subjects. Shout out to Sarah Abbott and Taylor Schwenk, our fantastic producers, making sure everything went smoothly. Enjoy your off season. The podcast coming back next week. Thank you.